Hey friends, you're listening to Changing the Conversation, a podcast by African Leadership and the Mocha Club, where we take time to sit down and explore topics to challenge our perspective in pursuit of better loving people and the world around us.
Thanks for joining us here today. I think it's a Tuesday when you guys are listening to this. Our podcast is called Changing the Conversation. And for those of you who have not joined us before, we discuss everyday topics, but how they end up being very different when you view it from different perspectives. So we've had the opportunity of spending a lot of our time in Africa with men and women who are changing the landscape of Africa for the better and doing that in some really unique ways that end up painting a very different picture of the world. So today we're joined in the studio with our country director, Alan Knowles from South Africa, who runs all of our program and ministry there. Hi, Alan.
Hello, good morning.
And we also have with us today a very special guest, African Leadership's director of all of our international program, Emily Hickey.
Hi.
Hi. How is everybody today?
Well, thank you.
Pretty good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
It's an early morning. Have you had enough coffee?
We'll see.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
Alan, do you drink a lot of coffee in South Africa?
No, probably 3-4 cups a day.
Like all in the morning or spread out throughout the day?
One about 9-10 o'clock, one at 4, and then maybe 2 cups at night.
At night? And then go to sleep?
Yeah.
I do that too.
Really?
It doesn't really affect me.
Sometimes as late as 10, 11.
If I have a cup of coffee past 5 o'clock, I won't go to bed at 9. Like my body can't fall asleep.
No, but I find that coffee in the U.S., if I drink coffee after, filter coffee after 9, yeah, then I'd struggle. But generally, I don't have a problem sleeping.
Wow. You drink it that late, Emily?
We're immune to the caffeine. We've evolved to that point.
That's impressive. All right, so let's talk about South Africa. Alan, help us understand a bit about the South Africa that you are currently living in. I know that when most people think about Africa in general, they assume lots of dirt, they assume a pretty high level of poverty, pretty wild landscape. Lots of people have seen images of Cape Town and the lushness, the richness of this beautiful kind of secluded area right up against the ocean. But what does a day-to-day life look like for you in South Africa?
Yeah, you know, I live in Cape Town, so I can speak more for Cape Town. South Africa is a first world and a third world country that coexists. And you can be in a first world setting and drive 10 minutes, 15 minutes away and be in a third world kind of setting. So, yeah, I think the gap is widening, you know, between the rich and the poor. But the communities that I grew up in was poor communities. And the communities I work in, yeah, are very disadvantaged. And the poverty is very, very real. And the brokenness is very, very evident, yeah. South Africa is made up of 4 major race groups. White, black, which is more your tribal. Indian, which is about 1 million people, and then colored. And so in some of the Indian communities, black communities and the colored communities, yeah, the poverty can be very alarming.
Emily, you and Alan often talk about the dynamics of South Africa that kind of make it unique on the continent, sports related, politics related. What do you find most fascinating about South Africa?
One of the things I always think about when I talk to Alan is that I think it's really easy for us to always think about our differences with other people, but there's that saying that a smile or laughing is a universal language, and I think we both would agree if you put a soccer ball in front of someone, it does you a whole lot better than staring at them smiling. So what I think has always been interesting to me about South Africa is that intersection of politics and culture and sports and the way that it has played out over the history. If you look back into the 60s and South Africa gets banned by FIFA for non-discrimination, violating its non-discrimination policy, and kind of gets embarrassed, for lack of a better word, on the international stage. And then Mandela comes into office and they let South Africa back into FIFA.
Yeah.
And Mandela has this whole idea that sport can break down racial barriers better than government and it can change the world and can sustain peace. I'm wondering if you can speak to if you found that to be true or what kind of role soccer, or we can call it football, has played in South African culture?
Yeah, I think, you know, when Mr. Mandela took over the country was very polarized and divided. So I think he sought a way of winning over, you know, the confidence, particularly of the Afrikaner people, which was rugby. And so I think his big statement, if you, 1995, when South Africa won the Rugby World Cup, he put on the South African rugby Springbok jersey. And that gave him a connection with the Afrikaner community, which for which rugby is a religion. I mean, I think at that level, you know, it brought people together. I think our problem is that our communities, under the apartheid system, our communities were segregated by law. So you had white, black, colored, Indian living in their own communities. And so while today you can live where you want to, if you're able to do that, but most people still live in their own communities. And so in that way, we're still apart. So our sport largely still takes place in our own communities. So unless you go and play for a team on the other side of the, you know, line, you're not really going to have integration. So the integration, when there's no integration, lots of that has to do with purely where people, you know, live. But the government has a policy to ensure that there's integration. And so they have a system where they will insist that at the national level, that the teams must include a certain number of people of color. So, you know, that's where we are, you know, at the moment. And, you know, obviously some folks like it and some folks don't like it, but yeah.
I know in other countries, at least Zimbabwe, I think was like this, there tend to be, if there's like rival teams, they can come to represent rival factions in the government. And Mugabe's political party at one point was kind of represented by one of the big teams in Zimbabwe. Yeah. And so it kind of became a, you're on this side or this side, and it's not just sport, it's political, and you're bankrolled by the government, and it's kind of an outlet that turns into more than, yeah, it turns into more than just fun. Do you think that has ever been an issue in South Africa where it's come to represent more than just sport?
You know, I think one must go back to appreciate the feelings, you know, of apartheid and sport. So rugby more so, because the way the political bodies who were banned in the early years fought the system was to get FIFA and to get the rugby world to exclude South Africa. So that really hurt the Afrikaner community, that they couldn't play rugby on the international stage. So when they were allowed to come back, the country, and again, more so the people of color, never fully embraced the national rugby team or the cricket team. Those were largely, you know, white institutions. So when opposing teams would come and play there, like New Zealand, people of color stood behind the New Zealand team and supported them. You know, so that's how we could win some little victory, you know, over the Afrikaner people. Now, in many ways, that hasn't changed to this day. And while there's a large group of people who now embrace the rugby team fully, but they are just last Saturday, South Africa and New Zealand played, and New Zealand beat South Africa. So you would have half of people supporting South Africa and half. Now, a few years ago, the finance minister of the country, I mean, he publicly stated that he supported New Zealand. I mean, that caused quite a stir. And yeah. People felt that he was betraying Mandela's vision. But yeah, those feelings still lie very deep.
It's kind of reminiscent of, I know soccer was brought to Africa by European and Christian missionaries. Mm. And it kind of was a way to establish their culture and keep it together for their comfort. And then as you get more Africans involved and it becomes this rallying cry of, this is our local identity, we can beat you in the sport. Yeah. And it turns into more of an anti-colonization movement because of that. So that still kind of is present, that it's a rallying point or an organizational point that brings people together just as much as it can set people apart.
I mean, I think those may be underlying issues. Mm-hmm. I know when England comes, you know, there's there are rivalries, you know, when England comes. But not just between people of colour in rugby, you know, South Africa and England. You know, there are attitudes where South Africa wants to show. But yeah, you know, I think people are trying to get on with, you know. South Africa wants to be among the best in the world in sport. So that's a huge driving, motivating fact.
And you have told me before things that South Africans or the government does to help their team win. Can you talk about some of those things?
Well, certainly the soccer more so. Having a witch doctor in the life of a community, it's a part of African life. You know, the recognition of the ancestors, that's a part of African life. So for teams, you know, for local teams to consult a witch doctor to have a part in the outcome of a game, it's
normal.
So teams have witch doctors that are kind of
teams would have witch doctors that they would appeal to.
So where we have like a medical physician that services one sports team, y'all have a witch doctor?
No, the teams would have, because they're professional, they would have the medical and those kind of resourceful people as a part of it. But, you know, to determine the outcome of that game, the greater the witch doctor. So opposing teams will have, you know, witch doctors. And I recall some years ago watching a game, local game on television, and it was close to where I live. And at halftime, they showed, I mean, smoke billowing, you know, out of the stadium. It looked like the stadium was on fire. And found out afterwards that, you know, they had been given things to burn, you know, in the dressing room.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes on a Monday night in South Africa, they will show you highlights of the weekend's game. And they normally end that program with a funny moment during the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it may be something a player did or the referee did. Well, they showed one day an official. And you can only get onto the pitch if you have a badge clearance. Well, they showed this official walking along the goalposts throwing some powder or something. So he was the clown of the week. Hopefully that this will influence, you know, a game. And so I've seen a lot of these things on television. And so the opposing one team may take their jerseys, their socks, and give it to the witch doctor a few days before the game, you know, to bless it or do whatever he has to do to provide some kind of advantage. But when we had the World Cup in 2010, and South Africa was desperate to do well because we were the host nation. And months after the World Cup, according to one of the newspapers, the soccer body recognized that they admitted this. They hired a witch doctor to help with the games, and they hadn't paid him. And he then was suing them, and he then said he would curse the team and they would never win again until they paid him.
Like the Cubs.
And so what happened was, from the time we played the World Cup to when this incident made headlines in the newspaper, I think it was 9 games South Africa had played since the World Cup, and they hadn't won.
They had not?
They had not won in these 9 games. Now, they hadn't lost all of these games. They may have tied it, but they didn't win. And so I think that kind of desperation, which again tells you something about how the administrators of the game think. And so they settled, made sure they paid the guy.
It would be ironic, I think, in our world, like we're in postseason baseball right now. It would be strange for the Red Sox to hire a chaplain or something to bless or skew the favor of the gods in one direction or another. So talk a little bit about how the culture in South Africa holds something like a cultural norm and belief in ancestral worship, or the at least the appeasing of ancestors. But you've also mentioned that they're pretty apathetic spiritually as a nation, as a group of people. So how do both of those things coexist?
I mean, you know, I think people are superstitious, you know, in sport generally, and while your baseball or football teams may not resort to a level of witch doctor, but
I do drink from the same mug every time the Red Sox are going to play.
I was going to say, I have things like that, maybe.
You have those kind of, you know, you have those kind of superstitions. You know, they'll put on a certain boot first, the left boot first. If you watch players, particularly, you see it more with soccer. And if you see it in Europe more, when they go onto the field, they'll make the sign of the cross. I mean, you'll see that often when the guy scores a goal, he'll point to the heaven. So, you know, there is that kind of superstition. But I think in African culture, where the role of the witch doctor and the need to, you know, have the blessing of the ancestors, it's a part of life. It's how people have grown up. And, you know, that's a very real part of life. And while I think as a nation we are not as spiritually, I'm talking about in terms of one's personal relationship with the Lord, I don't think we are as spiritually responsive as some of the other African countries. I mean, I think spiritually, in terms of how we respond to our relationship to the Lord, I think we are, you know, complacent and not as vibrant.
You mentioned the World Cup a little bit ago. And I think from those of us that watched it in 2010, it made Cape Town look like this beautiful place that's so modernized, and all of the economic prosperity that they promised this would bring to the area, it looks like it happened. But you were there in all of the building process, and you still are there now. What did it look like behind the scenes? Have those promises become reality, or is it still, it's just, it's exacerbated the problem?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I like sport. I played sport. I wasn't a supporter of the idea that we should get the World Cup. I think there were more important issues for us to address as a country. But, yeah, we spend enormous amounts of money building soccer stadiums, which are not utilized today. The city of Cape Town, where I live, they didn't know what to do with the stadium because the local team, you know, they wanting to build their own stadium and they thinking of a capacity of 10,000 people. So we don't draw huge crowds. We have three teams in the country that when they play, those three teams play each other, you know, they can get 60 to 80,000 people in a stadium, but by and large, we don't. So they built stadiums in some places where we didn't even have a professional, you know, soccer team. So I don't think we've reaped the dividends and the benefits of what it was supposed to.
What sports did you play growing up?
I largely played soccer. It was the one sport that you didn't need. Cricket, you need a bat, you need pads. Soccer, you needed a ball. That's all. And so the kind of communities I grew up in, there weren't many fields available. So you'd play on the sidewalk or you just play in the middle of the street, you know. And so, yeah, you just needed a ball.
What was your upbringing like in South Africa? Can you describe your setting? It's not what some people picture in like a village or a rural setting. What was it like for you to grow up?
Yeah, I grew up in a community that would be, you know, likened to your inner cities. You know, Cape Town has political designations for where people live. The first time I came to one community in the U.S., they told me I'd be staying in a township that night. A township in South Africa is not a nice place. Well, I saw this, it was New Jersey somewhere, the Wall Township. It was a very, very nice community, but a township in South Africa, it's not a nice place. It's, you know, the kind of community. So in the colored community that I grew up in, it was called the Cape Flat, a three-bedroom house, but very basic. We were a family of, by the time I was born, we were 9, but I told we were 10. My eldest brother had died, I think, within months of being born. So, yeah, you know, and parents are in a small three-bedroom house. We had three. We were more fortunate. Some people had two. Some people had one room.
You had a three-bedroom house, 9 kids and 2 adults. So 11 people in a three-bedroom house.
1 bathroom, toilet together. Small enough you couldn't change your mind in it.
Small enough you can't change your mind. That's amazing. Man, so you grew up, you're the youngest?
No, there's 3 younger than
3 after you.
Yeah.
So you're kind of running around in the middle of this brood.
Yeah.
brothers, sisters? What's the dynamic?
Yeah, we were four. There's four sisters. And
four sisters, five boys.
Yeah.
Okay. So did you go to school right there in the community?
Yeah. Again, our schools were, you know, racially segregated. So depending on your nationality, that's where you went to school. So yeah, I went to a school close to where I lived. And so, you know, you walk to school.
I think it's easy to look at it now and see it as an obvious injustice, but when you're growing up in the middle of it, do you just think, oh, this is how it is? Or do you think this is completely wrong and this needs to change? What is the mindset when you're in the middle of it?
Yeah, I think, you know, obviously how we responded had a lot to do with our parents. You know, if you grew up in a home where your parents felt, look, you know, this is normal, then if you grew up in a home where your parents were more outspoken, the home I grew up in, you know, we were sort of, I mean, we talk about the injustices and we talk about the things that we were denied. And I think as a little boy, when you don't know anything. You live in this town. Everybody is the same race, is largely the same color. You go to the same stores, you go to this. You never leave this community unless you work outside of that community. So you may go downtown. Well, then you see people you haven't seen before. I mean, you consider this normal, you know, as a child because you don't know anything else. But I think as a kid, where it started to dawn on me is when I remember I was going as a family, and again, nine children and two parents, and I'm having to get on the train. And I mean, that was quite a thing, you know, to get. And out the trains were segregated. So there was a section that we would have to sit in. And where the train stopped, you know, it stopped where we were standing, you know, it was closer to the section where only white folks could sit, you know. And so you're wondering, why can't we just get in there? Why is my father taking all this time to get us through this door where, and we're going to, the conductor's blowing his whistle, this train's going to move, you know. And so then it begins to dawn on you. And then we go to the beach. We never had a car, so to get all of us on a bus to get to the station and then to get on a train, and because the beaches were segregated. So some of the, we would go to this one beach which was closest to where we lived, and the day after Christmas is the public holiday in that summer, so everybody goes to this beach, and I mean, you have to get there like 6 o'clock in the morning to secure a little place. And then you're on this beach, well, the beach across the way, you know, that's only for white folks, but there's a handful of people on the beach. And so then it begins to dawn on you, why are we, you know, limited mm-hmm. to this? And so, yeah, so as a child, you start, that's where I sort of got my awareness of this. And
as I'm assuming as a child, then you start asking questions.
Yeah.
Why can't we go over there? Why do we have to, why are you taking this long to get? What was the story or the narrative that was being told to you, being crafted? Was it one that added to the sense of injustice and creating a place of defiance for you? Or was it, as Emily suggested, just the way that life is?
Yeah, my mother was a more passive person. My father was a vociferous, and he was an aggressive, and he'd fight, you know, literally he would physically fight. And so my father would, and I remember at times having to take a train, you know, the conductor would be an Afrikaner, white, very forceful, aggressive, overbearing kind of person. He could pitch you off the train. And my father would stand up, and my father would want to pick a physical fight with him. That was his response to the system. Now, my mother was more of a passive, you know, toe the line, look, you know, it will work out one day. Just, you know, let's stay out of trouble. Don't get involved. When I got to my late teenage years, you know, that's when I started to become very angry. Downtown Cape Town is where our Senate is, you know, call it the Parliament. And I'd walk past those places, and yeah, I had some very nasty thoughts of what I wish I could do. Yeah, but yeah, that's when I started to, you know, the real impact began to dawn on how you know, evil the system was, yeah.
So what's it like to live in that transition where you move from that into the age of Mandela?
Yeah, I think the system of apartheid, it was a brutal system. And besides what it denied people and the obvious disadvantages, but I think the propaganda and the mental damage it did to us as a people, that's very sad because it turned people against each other. When I grew up as a kid, I was about 6 years old, there was an African family, tribal people who lived behind our house. And then laws were really passed. It was called the Group Areas Act. And so they'd move you. You then had to go and live in certain communities. And so these people were moved to whichever areas were designated for them. That was the last time I saw, probably for the next few years, I saw tribal black people, unless I went into other towns where people worked. So largely, you know, we were isolated. They isolated us. I saw white people when I would go in downtown, or if you went into a work situation or into a bank. Our churches were largely segregated. So we never saw. So we grew up in our own communities.
Yeah, whereas everyone celebrated the end of apartheid, it still felt kind of the same if you were there and just as segregated of a community.
Yeah, and I think the propaganda, you know, we didn't trust each other. Mm-hmm. You know, the propaganda and what Mandela had to overcome. I think what people don't appreciate about him was the greatness of his heart, what he had to overcome. Because he had been demonized. And so to win over, you know, people were divided. And I think there are still people like that, you know, today. And I think as the crime and the violence increases in the country, people become more and more suspicious of each other.
You need someone to blame.
Yeah, well, yeah. Then you start seeing somebody. So you start making generalize. Mm-hmm. So every person of color or every white person is a bad person, and so you start generalizing. And so I think for myself is you've got to fight your instincts now that when things are done to you by a particular race group that you cannot generalize and say, you know,
Right. Every
person is. But no, it's been a tough and a difficult road for the country to get beyond. Constitutionally, apartheid has been changed, but the inbred insecurities and fears and prejudices are still there. And it's across the board, you know. So it's still there. And so we have to fight that every day. And certainly as a Christian, you know, how do I then respond and love my neighbor in a way that befits one who is a Christian?
Yeah.
What did that process look like for you to go through? You're late in your teenage years, walking past the Senate Parliament building, having these completely understandable but strong, angry, bitter feelings towards the injustice of your lifestyle. And now you are fighting to equip local men and women around the gospel, around biblical truth of loving one another, of fighting and caring well for the people in your community. What was that process for you? What's your personal story with that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I was, you know, besides the injustice of the apartheid, I grew up in a home, and I was an abused child. So, you know, from an emotional point of view, I was also a very disturbed and broken child. And the communities I grew up, you know, gangs and people standing on street corners and, you know, and thugs and that kind of thing. And so, but for the grace of God, I was very close to being pulled into that lifestyle. I was inches away when I encountered the Lord in a salvation experience. And so, you know, it took years. Finally, when I came to an understanding of the gospel, and when I went to Bible school, that's really when my growth and a lot of the transforming power of the gospel in its broader sense began to, you know, impact and affect my life. And the truth of what it means to have a relationship with God, that brought a lot of healing and hope to my life. And so today, you know, working with younger men, you know, that's the witness and the testimony I try to install in them. The gospel is adequate and sufficient, not just in its narrow sense of, you know, bringing us to Christ, but in its broader sense of rebuilding our lives. It does give hope and strength to us. And so I try to, you know, be an instrument in the Lord's hands in working with the students.
What are some of the promises that, you know, you just kind of described that in the broader sense of the places where the gospel brings hope and life to your story, what were some of those larger points or promises in the scriptures that really did begin that healing work for you from your personal family story into something that, it totally transformed your identity?
Yeah, you know, as I said, I grew up in a home. My father was a very abusive man, very abusive. By the age of 7 or 8, I'd run away twice to get away, just to get away from him. Unfortunately, I just ran to the next street not knowing and naively thinking that, you know, I had this friend at school and, yeah, he said, you know, come home with me. And I just went home with him and thought maybe, you know, I could just stay with him. Well, his father came home and it was about 8 or 9 o'clock the night and said, no, you need to go home, you know. So they took me back home and I got a very severe beating. And then I ran away again. And obviously, I had to come back home again. But I certainly have. My father died when I was 10, and so coming to the Lord and then hearing that God is a father, you know, my associations of my father, that's the image, you know. But I very clearly remember sitting in a Bible class, Bible school one day, and one of the passages that hammered this truth to me, Romans 5:6-8, while we were sinners, Christ died for us. That's when God demonstrated his love toward us. I mean, I could see that scene today. And, you know, being told that at our worst, when we were most unattractive and nothing impressive about ourselves, God made the commitment to set his love upon us, set his love upon me. And that there is ultimately absolutely nothing I can do to earn or merit any goodness from him. And that was the moment that began this transformation. And the real desire then to get to know God, to want to know God and allow the truth of what the gospel teaches about God to grip and be the way, the foundation upon which I will build my life and not, you know, not feelings and... I came to the Lord in my teenage years, and I sensed the call to preach. I sensed the call to preach. But my fear of failure, the voice of my father and many other people who told me, you know, I wouldn't amount to much in life, I heard that louder than the Lord's voice. So I struggled profoundly with the call to preach. And Lorraine, who I married years later, told me one day, because we grew up in the same church, and she said to me, you're struggling with your sense of, you know, can God use you? She said, there's hope for you. I want to share scripture with you. And she told me the story about how God spoke through a donkey. She said, there's hope for you.
She would say that.
When I went to Bible school, you know, the sense that, you know, I could fail, you know, and... And the church I went to, people didn't encourage going to Bible school. It wasn't an encouragement, you know. And I'd hear these stories from people who say to me, you know, the Lord called me and I didn't want to go to Bible school and I didn't want to go and then I broke my back and my neck. And I said, God, you don't have to do that to me, you know. I'm quite happy to go, but I struggled with the fear of failure because a lot of what my father had said to me. And so I remember... I got through my first year, but in the chapel service, we had chapel once a week, and I had never heard an expositional sermon in my life, you know, in a true technical, the way you expound a passage of scripture. I'd never heard it in my life because I grew up in a church where nobody preached like that. So we sat in the chapel and I'd hear people preach, you know, these expositional sermons. The senior students would say, well, from next year, in your second and third year, that's how you have to preach. Well, I sat there and I thought, you know, I'm never going to be able to do that. And so then my fear of failing just, you know, intensified. So I went to the president at the end of my first year. And I said to him, could you excuse me from the preaching classes, please? I just can't see myself doing it. Now, bear in mind, I went to Bible school because I wanted to. I sensed God calling me to preach and I wanted to pray. So he said to me, no, this, you will do this. This is what you will do. So that was the end of the year, November, and we went for the summer break. We came back in February. It was the worst summer of my life.
Waiting it out.
Yeah. And so we came back in February, and there were only four of us in the class, two males and two females. And these two ladies who were females, they had really come to prepare for children's ministry. And so he said, look, since you're not preparing for real preaching, I'm not too worried about you ladies, but these two guys, yeah, you're going to preach. So 2 days a week, we had a preaching class. So we'd have to have a sermon outline every Tuesday and Thursday. He'd give you a passage and construct this outline. And to cut a long story short, the Lord showed his faithfulness, and I got through it. And so as I've grown in my relationship with the Lord, you know, I've grown to understand, you know, that when we're faithful to God, and God gives grace to carry us through challenging situations. And so when I'm teaching in classes now, where I see a lot of myself in some of the students because of some of their background and their circumstances and their struggles, I see a lot of myself in them, and I am able to help and offer them that you can. You know, you can overcome these things, and I see it. You know, I see their growth.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's hard about having a fear of failure, not that I know, I do, is that you feel like the success that you have to not be a failure is so big that you can't overcome it. There's no level or magnificence of success that will ever make you not a failure. I started thinking of when you talked about Lorraine is that she is someone that I think is an example of you don't need to be the pastor that has a church full of 200 people every Sunday to make a difference. You don't need to be a career humanitarian to make a difference. Lorraine sees, I think you both do, see service as an act of everyday life, and you make a difference. I think about your neighbor who Lorraine takes care of, and you talk about your students as statements of hope, and I think that's a really important facet of also being afraid of failure and having that bar of success so high.
You know, the gospel's about rebuilding people and society, I think, with the fall of Adam. You know, God's rebuilding and restoring that image in which he created us in. And so, yeah, that's what I seek to do with my life, is to be a part of the instrument of rebuilding, you know, people's lives through the trustworthiness of the scripture.
And it doesn't always look so grand, but it's something we just don't see.
Yeah. As one shapes the life of a student, you know, that person then becomes a better person and a better citizen and a better...
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you mean when you say your goal or your hope is that your students would, their lives would become statements of hope? What is that vision in your brain when you use that phrase?
I mean, the gospel is called the gospel of hope. Paul says to the Colossians, chapter 1, calls it the gospel of hope. The very essence of me having a relationship with the Lord is about hope. Peter says we've been given a living hope through the new birth. When the Bible describes a non-believer, it says, you know, before you were without God and without hope. And so when we are impacted by the gospel in salvation experience, then it's to be a picture of hope. It's to show people, you know, that what we believe, we are people of hope. We are to be people of hope. It doesn't take away from the difficulties and the challenges. You know, to live out our faith strongly in whatever the circumstances we face. It's to be people who are confident. It's to be people who are strong in their faith. It's to be people who are bold in their faith. You know, that's what we are wanting to instill in our students, a bold abandonment to God.
Hope seems to be a pretty prevalent theme for everything you've talked about today. I mean, from the buy-in that men and women had to Mandela. I mean, he pursued people and he dreamt of a life that created hope, that literally inspired men and women to leverage who they were towards something that would be more beautiful. But you've seen that come true in your own life, a place of brokenness and deep wrestling over your identity and your value, and how God used people like Lorraine or the truth of his word to create and instill and foster hope. And it's what you appear to be and fighting to create for men and women that come after you.
Yeah.
I think that's all of what our life is to be about, is that process of appreciating and learning it for ourselves and then looking for all of the opportunities for us to extend it to other people.
Yeah.
That's great.
All right. Well, thank you all for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Changing the Conversation. Alan, thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to be here with us.
Thank you very
much. Safe travels back to South Africa.
Thank you.
Bring Lorraine next time.
Bring Lorraine next time.
And she'll come to
the podcast. Not that we didn't love our time with you, but we could do some fun podcasting with Lorraine. Emily, thanks for joining us. I always appreciate your insight and perspective. Hopefully we can get you on more podcasts. We'll give you lots of coffee. Sign you up. For those of you listening, please send us your comments and your feedback. And as always, check us out on our socials at African Leadership or at Mocha Club. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Subscribe. Thanks, guys. Have a great day.